From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Ford reportedly ready to cut jobs to jumpstart its stock.
What's so frustrating at General Motors and Ford particularly is that these two companies are making more money in North America, specifically the United States, than they have almost in your and my lifetimes. And investors are just yawning.
He's the son of Egyptian immigrants, a physician, and he wants to be Michigan's next governor. We meet Dr. Abdul El Sayed.
Government is about delivering a set of services that create opportunity for people who fundamentally need it. It needs people who believe in what it can do, believe in the value of the people it serves.
And a salute to the Michigan Opera Theater's Dr. David DiChiara.
He is responsible for opera being in Detroit. He is responsible for the restoration of the Detroit Opera House. And you can't say enough good things about him.
But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for being with us today. Ford has reportedly come up with an answer to its lackluster stock performance. The Wall Street Journal reports Ford's getting ready to cut about 10% of its jobs to help boost the stock. Subsequent reports say the cuts would be mainly salaried workers in North America and Asia, and not hourly jobs. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. Daniel, demand for Ford vehicles is pretty strong. Business is good. So why are we here talking about the possibility of job cuts?
Well, I think clearly what CEO Mark Fields and Chairman Bill Ford want to convey to the street is a sense of purpose and that they're going to continue to run a tight ship. Whether this has any impact on the stock, I think, remains to be seen. It's not unusual for industries and companies, and auto companies, frankly, to take these kinds of measures. It's a little unusual for them to take them at the top of the business cycle, which is essentially what they would be doing here if they were, in fact, to move ahead with this. And I suspect that something will be coming, that they are looking at it. I think the thing that Ford is dealing with is that they really don't have a lot of answers. I wrote about this last week. They really don't have a lot of answers to shareholders saying to them, what are you going to do to juice the stock?
Because they had a pretty unhappy shareholders meeting, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. It was very unusual. It was the first time it was a digital shareholder meeting, and I couldn't tell you the last time, if ever, I'd been to a Ford annual meeting, and I didn't go to this one either. Nobody went to it. They sat and listened to it on their computer, and people were able to ask questions, and to Bill Ford's credit primarily, he took a lot of questions, I think a lot more questions than they would have taken in a traditional annual meeting. But I clearly got the impression, and this is the thrust of a piece I wrote last week, that they really didn't have a lot of answers. That, you know, a lot of the mobility stuff and the electrification and autonomy that we've been talking a lot about on your air really is speculative and on if come. I mean, they're investing in it, but it's not bringing in any revenue, and it's certainly not delivering any profits. And what is delivering profitability is the traditional, primarily, truck and SUV business. So what are they going to do, build more trucks and SUVs? All that's going to do is reinforce the fact that this is an old-line industrial auto company and that doesn't have the upside growth. So really what I think they're trying to do is find some kind of sweet spot that gets them a little bit more traction.
As we speak right now, Ford has not confirmed it's cutting jobs. In fact, in its statement, here is the exact phrasing. Quote, we have not announced any new people efficiency actions, which is an interesting way of describing firing people, no?
I'll just leave it at that.
All right. So help us understand how people efficiency actions could give anybody's stock a jump start.
Well, I think if you are, let's look at this a little differently. If you were announcing that you were going to cut back, for example, you were going to eliminate plants and rationalize your production, that might have an impact. If you were to announce that you were going to leave a portion of the world like General Motors is doing in Europe, because for 15 years you've been losing money and lost about $20 billion over 15 years, that might have an impact on your stock. But the fact is, General Motors did that, and their shares are still kind of treading water. So that really hasn't moved the needle. Now, I think the reason they did it is because they believe they can get better profitability in other parts of the world. And again, I think that investors look at that, but they're looking for something that breaks out of the traditional mold. And none of these kinds of traditional things are really going to do that. And my own sense is that as long as they're playing from the traditional automotive playbook, we'll rationalize a salaried workforce. That happens a lot. It happens in a lot of different areas. Sometimes you don't hardly even hear about it if it's small enough. I don't think that's going to have the impact. We're at a point right now where the traditional industry and the mobility piece of the industry are kind of coexisting, but they're not equal contributors. And meanwhile, they're looking at Silicon Valley and seeing companies out there that are moving ahead and partnering and doing other kinds of things. The most recent was an alliance between Google's Waymo and Lyft, a ride-sharing company. And I think that got some people's attention. And those kinds of things are more likely to captivate the investor who's looking forward. What they're trying to do here, let's remember, they're looking for growth and they're looking forward and they're looking at who's going to be doing the next new thing. And I think right now what the market is saying is we don't think Ford's part of that story.
And to that point, how can a big auto company like Ford balance performance today with planning for the future, which certainly requires a lot of investment in R&D in order to not get left behind in the autonomous vehicle race?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And if you and I could answer it, we wouldn't be sitting here talking on the radio, okay? And we'd be traveling around the world.
Sharing our wisdom.
Yes, exactly. I think that's the question people are trying to wrestle with. What's so frustrating at General Motors and Ford particularly is that these two companies are making more money in North America, specifically the United States, than they have almost in your and my lifetimes. And investors are just yawning, saying, oh, okay, you got net margins of over 10% in North America? Oh, well, big deal. It used to be, I covered General Motors in various parts of the world for close to 25 years. And I can tell you for a big chunk of that, they wanted to get to 5% margins. And now they're doubling up on those things, and investors are just kind of saying, oh, big deal. And meanwhile, you've got Tesla, who in the first quarter sold 25,000 cars. I love this number.
Yeah.
Lost $13,200 on every single one.
Wow.
And they're valued at more than Ford in the marketplace and almost General Motors, depending on the day.
Finally, quickly, what does all this say about the market's confidence in Ford CEO Mark Fields?
Mark had the misfortune, if you will, of following Al Mulally. Mm-hmm. And Al Mulally was, of his day, probably the superstar CEO. He's the one who brought Ford Motor Company back from the brink. But what's really, really important for people to remember is that Alan restructured the traditional auto piece of the business. That's what he did. He rationalized the product portfolio, the plant network, the people, and he did it very effectively. But now, all of a sudden, Mark Fields is faced with the fact that I got to keep Alan's traditional industry running and continuing to churn out product and profitability, and at the same time make the smart bets and have the smart partnerships in the mobility space and somehow make that transition. We're in a transition point right now. Ford's in a transition point, and it's not easy. It's proving not to be easy, and there's a lot of skepticism among investors because, remember, it was only 8 years ago that these companies were on the brink of extinction.
Just a confluence of things happening in automotive history.
Well, you know, investors have long memories. And I think the other thing is that Detroit has a long history of destroying capital. And now they're saying, we're not doing that anymore. Well, yeah, okay. Well, you did it in the past. Can you get through a downturn in this market, which is going to come at some point, and still not incinerate capital and still deliver profitability the way you say you can because your break-even points are a lot lower? And so I think there's also a certain wait and see about the traditional side of the business.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Take the game of golf, fold in frisbees, mix it all up, and you've got disc golf. It's on the rise in Michigan. Don Jensen is here to tell us more. Don's the owner of Sweet Spot Disc Golf in Muskegon. So, Don, this was a new one for me. What is disc golf, and how do you play it?
Well, disc golf is the same strategy as ball golf, and you use a disc, which is not a frisbee. It's much smaller and weighted different, and we throw those to our targets, which are called baskets. So the strategy is that of ball golf, but it combines that with the beauty of flying something, which happens to be the disc.
And is the course the same size? Is it a smaller size?
Courses range from, generally they're all par threes, but the trend now is to make larger courses, par fours and par fives. Par threes can range anywhere from a 175-foot hole to a 680-foot hole. It just depends. There's a wide range of courses. Some are really wooded, some are open, wind effects play. So there's a range of different courses out there for different abilities.
Do we know who came up with this?
Well, there's a lot of, you know, there's a history of it. The pie tin is one thing. Whammo was the first one to patent it, the Frisbee. Disc golf The way it is now was probably started in California in the late 70s, and the target followed, which is the basket. So it started in California like a lot of things do and migrated this way. And funny enough, the Midwest has the highest concentration of disc golfers.
Why is that? Why is the Midwest and why is West Michigan such a hotbed for disc golf?
Well, I think, you know, the concentration, the number of people in the Midwest, we have a lot of land and, you know, you might need 20 acres for a large course. So in the Midwest, there's a lot of woods, a lot of rural area, so it's accustomed to a disc golf course.
Now, how quickly has the sport grown, especially in West Michigan?
We dubbed from essentially Saugatuck up to St. Ignace, the Gulf Coast. And we did that because, I mean, I think there's close to 400 disc golf courses in the state of Michigan, and we have our fair share over here. What we do have over here that a lot of courses don't is we don't quite have the population of Detroit or Lansing or Ann Arbor. So we have phenomenal courses with easy to go to the course and hop right on and start playing.
Who is the typical player?
Anyone can do it. Everybody's ability is different. The more athletic you are, you probably have a easier time with it, but anyone can pick up a disc and throw it. The main demographic, I would say, is 18 to 35.
Now, does the game go faster?
No. It just like putting and ball golf, it's difficult, and the game is about the same pace.
Well, it sounds fun, and certainly now that the weather is getting nice, people should think of giving this a try. And if you can say even little kids can come in and play, that means you don't have to worry about being an ace golfer.
No, you don't. And I wish I would have started as a child, because once you start, you don't have to give it up. And for those of us that are getting a little older, I can't run around on the basketball court any longer, but I can throw a disc. And golf is not all about strength and physical. It's a lot of mental. So there's a lot of strategy involved, and makes it easy for almost anyone to play.
Disc golf on the rise in Michigan. And we've been talking with Don Jensen. He's the owner of Sweet Spot Disc Golf in Muskegon. It was great talking with you. Thank you so much for sharing your passion for disc golf with us, Don.
Thank you, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
To be or not to be? That is the question.
It is time for Theater Talk as we check out the offerings from professional theater companies all over Michigan. As we say hello to David Kiley of Encore Michigan. David, I love jukebox musicals. I mean, Jersey Boys, Beautiful, Moving Out, I love them. And I know there's a new show opening at Meadowbrook Theater in Rochester that is going to make people like me very, very happy.
I think so. It's Why Do Fools Fall in Love, which is a question that I think a lot of us ask all the time.
Yes.
This is a nostalgic trip back to the 1960s, featuring one classic girl group number after another. The action takes place at a bachelorette party as a group of girlfriends tackle the big subjects of life, commitment, marriage, and they reveal some secrets about their own love lives in the course of the show. And the story in the show is peppered, obviously, with some of the 60s best love tunes, like obviously the title song.
Why do fools fall in love?
I will follow him.
And then My Boy Lollipop, and I Will Follow Him, and You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, Hey There Lonely Boy, all the stuff that so many of us just love from that period. And that show runs through May 25th through June 18th at the Meadowbrook.
And, you know, I know just from having seen Beautiful, when you start hearing those songs, it's amazing if you live through them. It just takes you right back. But it stuns me how many young folk love that era of music from the 60s?
You know, it is nostalgic, but it's so much fun, that
yes.
music, that when my son's 15, and I could totally take him to that show. And even though he's into electronic dance music and dubstep and things like that, he would like that show because the music is so fun.
Yeah, Motown the Musical is another one that just did
yeah.
it all ages and everybody was happy. So again, runs May 25th through June 18th at Meadowbrook Theater in Rochester in Oakland County. Why Do Fools Fall in Love? Now we head over to Northville to Tipping Point Theater. You call this one of Michigan's gems?
Yeah, a little bit, because I feel like it's still unknown to a lot of people. You know, it's in sort of downtown Northville, but kind of on the edge of town. And I didn't know about it until a few years ago when I took over Encore Michigan. And I've seen some terrific things there. It's an equity theater. And they're doing a show called The Ladies Foursome, which I should quickly add is about golf.
Okay, jump right in there.
And it's a follow to an earlier play that they did there called The Foursome, which was about four golfing buddies and kind of what happens on a golf course. And what's interesting about this show, I think, and about doing this show in general, is that it's a small theater. But these actresses, just like the actors, they're going to play 18 holes of golf in this very small theater space.
Okay. Well, let's take a listen to is it James Kuhl, the producing artistic director over at Tipping Point Theater, telling us why he thinks Ladies Foursome will resonate with audiences.
We found that the Tipping Point audiences have a very strong affinity to the playwright Norm Foster. He's a Canadian playwright that is very much in the same vein as Neil Simon. And so we've done a number of his plays, and so we finally came to The Foursome, which is a round of four old college buddies playing a round of golf, and the audience absolutely loved it. So it only made sense to follow it this season with Norm Foster's The Ladies Foursome, which isn't really a sequel to The Foursome. It has the same structure, really, but the difference is that we have four ladies now playing a round of golf as opposed to four men. And the ticket sales have been very, very strong. A lot of people are very, very excited for it because there's a strong need out there for some levity in the world, and this play will definitely provide that.
Oh, we do need levity. We do. So this is when he cites Neil Simon, that's kind of a good context, that kind of intelligent comedy.
Yes, it does have a lot of that feel. It's very accessible to people.
Very fun. So that's Ladies Foursome at the Tipping Point Theater in Northville, running May 18th to June 25th. Next up, a relatively new company in Trenton in Downriver Wayne County, Open Book Theater.
Right. They are in a new space in the last year or so. They used to be in a funny space that was in kind of an antique shop with a stage in the back, and now they have their own real space.
Which I'm sure is thrilling.
It is, and it's a terrific company. They have a play which actually opened this past weekend called Good People, which is a comedy by Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright David Lindsay Abaire, who wrote the play Rabbit Hole, which won him the Pulitzer Prize. I think that was in about 2009 or so. The play is set in South Boston, features a character named Margie Walsh, who's been let go from yet another job, something a lot of people can relate to. And the story is about her ideas and her trials to survive her financial and social plight. And it's directed by Angie Kane Ferrante, who is a young, talented director, and I know her from her work from the Purple Rose Theater and also Open Book. It's a terrific theater in Trenton doing wonderful selection of plays, and I really encourage people to check it out. It's also one of these small theaters that's kind of in a strip mall, mm-hmm. so you have to discover it a little bit, but once you go, you're going to want to go back.
Is this a drama?
No, it's
okay.
It's a
dramedy?
I would say it's a dramedy. There's a lot of humor in it, but it's because of the real situation, right?
Yeah.
There's laughs and there's also, you know, some real human dramedy is probably the best word for it.
All right. And from the wonderful Michigan Opera Theater, the only opera written by its retired artistic director, David DiChiara.
Yeah, Cyrano. It was written by David DiChiara. It was first performed about 8 or 9 years ago. He is the retiring artistic director of the Michigan Opera Theater. And it's a very special production because not only is DiChiara retiring from MOT this season, but he's also recently announced that he has a serious illness.
Yes.
And, of course, the opera is based on the story of Cyrano de Bergerac, a man with a very large nose who's in love with a beautiful woman named Roxanne, who he's forced to woo through a more, let's say, conventionally handsome man by coaching the man on what to say and how to behave toward Roxanne. A lot of people who may not have seen the play or something like that will have seen a movie called Roxanne with Steve Martin and Daryl Hannah, which
yes.
is based on the same story. But it's a beautiful, it just opened this past weekend. It will run next weekend. So get your tickets because we want to give De Chiara a really big, full house for his swan song.
Is it in English?
It's actually in French. But there will be English subtitles.
And again, knowing that people are really familiar with this, this could be a real good starting point for someone who might not have thought they might want to go to the opera.
Exactly. It's as familiar a story as Romeo and Juliet. And we should also say that there's a grand evening for David De Chiara's retirement and as I say, a swan song on May 19th at MOT, and there are tickets available for that as well.
Very worth it.
De Chiara is a treasure. He is responsible for opera being in Detroit. He is responsible for the restoration of the Detroit Opera House, and you can't say enough good things about him.
Well, just to recap, Why Do Fools Fall in Love at the Meadowbrook Theater in Rochester, Ladies Foursome at Tipping Point Theater in Northville, Good People at Open Book Theater in Trenton, and from the Michigan Opera Theater, Cyrano, and also, of course, the May 19th De Chiara Grand Salute. You'll get details on these and other productions all around Michigan. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley with Encore Michigan, thanks for taking us on another round of Theater Talk.
Thanks so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Fewer teenagers in Michigan are dying from accidents and disease, but teen deaths from suicide continue to rise. We need to talk to our teens about mental health issues, about suicide. But how? The Michigan chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness is offering some powerful new programs to high schools aimed at students, teachers, and parents. Allison Payne is a state trainer with NAMI Michigan, a volunteer also for NAMI in Washtenaw County, and an assistant professor at Lansing Community College. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
How did you come to be involved with NAMI Michigan?
Well, it's a journey that most of us don't want to take, and it involves our own children, which is where most of us with NAMI are there because of our children or our family members. So my son became suicidal when he was about 13, and it's a rude awakening for any parent. Thankfully, I was directed towards a NAMI class called NAMI Basics. We now have something called NAMI Family to Family class, which is a free class for parents or other family members living in support of people with mental health conditions. So I became involved, started researching, got involved with lots of things. I'm now teaching, presenting, talking to lots of people.
What did NAMI give you in terms of tools that helped you help your son?
NAMI gave me understanding. It gave me information, and it gave me hope. And I think hope is probably the biggest part of it all, because you are meeting people who have lived with a mental health condition, and you are learning some of the treatments because of their informational aspect. You're also meeting lots of people who've been through things very similar to yourself. And having hope gives you the strength to get through the days sometimes when it's a really rough day.
How is he now?
He's doing very, very well, thank you. He has come out of a large part of his depression. He's a college student. He's working. He has a girlfriend. He's happy. You don't get cured from mental health conditions, but you can get a whole lot better. And he's a whole lot better.
So the idea of programs like these ones aimed for high schools, for students, teachers, mm-hmm. and parents, ending the silence, and parents and teachers as allies, you've lived it.
Oh, yes. And these programs were not in place when I was starting on this journey with my son. So I found that a lot of teachers were unaware, uninformed, didn't really have a clue, just like me, didn't know what to do. So I said, you know what, These kids need help in schools. They need help from their parents. The teachers need help. I'm also a teacher. So when I learned about parents and teachers as allies, which we've been doing in Washtenaw County now for about 5 years, I think, I said, okay, I can do that. I'm a teacher. I'm a parent. And one of the things, one of the components of the program called Parents and Teachers as Allies is we have an informational PowerPoint that describes some of the warning signs of mental health conditions that you might see in children. Mm-hmm. And then it goes on to discuss what a teacher might see and how a teacher might be able to help that student in class. There's also a parent story, and I give my parent story. What was it like for my son in school? What helped? What hindered? And then we have a young adult give their story, and the young adults are always the star of the show, and they talk about what it was like for them, and they remember what they went through in school, and they talk about it, and they share it with the teachers so that the teachers can gain some understanding and some empathy and go, oh, I've seen that in my classroom. Wow.
And then you help them understand what's the next step to
yes,
take.
Yes.
Now, what about ending the silence? That's aimed at the students, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Ending the silence is aimed for presentations mostly in high schools, but also we're doing it a lot in middle schools, and we've also done some younger elementary schools. It is not yet evidence-based. Both programs are very close to becoming evidence-based. And it is where we present to the students. And then we also have a young adult speaking. And my son has done this to his old school.
And what's the message when these young adults come in? What are they saying to the kids sitting in front of
them?
What
they're saying is, I've been there, I know what it's like, and it can get better. It will get better. It's very, very powerful. Usually the adults in the audience are crying, or sometimes. And a lot of the youth in the audience, the students are going, oh, wow, I didn't want to tell anybody before, but now I think I could talk to somebody. My son presented at a training session that I had done a couple of weeks ago, and there was a woman in my training class who had lost her son to suicide. And she said to my son afterwards, if you had presented that and if my son had heard you speak, I think he would be alive today. So that shows you the power of the lived experience and showing that there's hope. And each story is different. I mean, there are some young adults that have experienced severe panic attacks. There's young adults who've had severe anxiety, severe depression, bipolar disorder, a plethora of different mental health conditions who are now trained and wanting to give back and give hope to other kids because they're alive, they're happy, they're doing well, they have their ups and downs. But for the most part, they're doing a whole lot better than they were when they might have felt suicidal at the age of 13, 14, 15, whatever it is.
And that, I know it's said so much, but you probably can't say enough of the fact that this stigma keeps kids from speaking out.
Absolutely. They're afraid to say anything. Very often, they don't really know what's going on. So there's certainly stigma, but a lot of it is they don't know why they feel like they do. Their stigma from parents. Some parents don't want to accept it. There's stigma from teachers. People say the wrong thing all the time. You know, oh, you'll be fine. When
yeah.
indeed the student is not fine and they can't make themselves fine.
So the idea that I'm gathering from NAMI Michigan is get these programs into as many schools as possible throughout Michigan before it's too late. Just what that mom said
yes.
to you or to
mm-hmm.
your son. If
mm-hmm.
my son had only heard you.
Yes, absolutely.
For teachers or for parents who mm-hmm. want this program in their child's school coming up, is there a cost to the school?
No, it's given totally for free. Nobody's paid to do it. Some of the students receive a small stipend for their gas and their time, mm-hmm. et cetera. But it is a totally free program. So it does astound me when we try to get into a school district and they say no. But the school districts that do have our programs are overwhelmed and they say, yes, please come again. Can you come next year? Let's do as many classes as we possibly can.
Again, the programs offered for free to high schools all throughout Michigan by NAMI Michigan. Parents and Teachers as Allies, again, aimed at staff and
parents.
Teachers and parents.
Mm-hmm.
And Ending the Silence, aimed at students. And in both cases, you get the young adults who can share the stories of what they have been through with mental health issues.
Yes.
Really powerful stuff. You can go to NAMIWC.org. That's the Washtenaw County website for NAMI, because lots and lots of good information is there for you. And you can always go just to NAMI.org, and that will get you through to a link to NAMI Michigan.
Yes.
Allison Payne, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, Dr. Abdul El-Sayed wants to be your next governor.
We've got to think about what a 21st century economy looks like. That means quitting playing from a 20th century playbook.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. New medical marijuana laws mean by this time next year, things will be very different in Michigan. The state will be handing out licenses to growers, testing facilities, transporters, and dispensaries. And that means the state will have to regulate and license this business as it expands. Let's see what's coming with the changes in medical marijuana in Michigan, a business some predict could generate revenues topping $700 million. Andrew Brisbois is with us. He's director of the new Bureau of Medical Marijuana Regulation. It's an arm of the State Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
What is your team charged with doing exactly?
Well, this new agency within LARA is responsible for the existing registry card program, which was set forth in 2008 via that voter initiative. And the new challenge is to implement the Medical Marijuana Facilities Licensing Act, which, as you said, is a commercialized version of that where facilities can grow and sell to patients.
So when you and I are talking a year from now, Michigan's medical marijuana industry is going to be different. Let's talk about what these new laws create. First, three kinds of growers. What are those?
Well, the grower category is split into three different groups, class A, B, and C. And the difference there is the number of plants that those facilities are allowed to grow. The class A is the smallest. They can grow 500. Class B can grow up to 1,000. And class C, 1,500 plants.
And then five classes of licenses. Would you break those down for us?
Sure. So the growers is pretty self-explanatory. They're allowed to grow medical marijuana. Processors are facilities that take raw marijuana product and turn it into other types of products we call marijuana-infused products, such as derivatives and tinctures and edibles. The provisioning centers are the retail establishments, the storefront, if you will, that will sell directly to the patients and caregivers. Secure transporters are responsible for carrying the marijuana and the marijuana-infused products between the various facilities. And the safety compliance facilities are essentially testing labs that will run all the tests to ensure that product is safe for human use and consumption.
Who will actually approve these licenses, Andrew?
Well, that will be a joint effort between the department and the Medical Marijuana Facilities Licensing Board. The applicants will have to meet the criteria set forth in the statute as well as the administrative rules.
How will your bureau work with this board? I guess I'm wondering, do you get to mandate things? Are you going to be recommending? And who gets the final say?
It's a cooperative arrangement. Our department deals with many boards in various capacities, so we have a great deal of experience in working with those appointed bodies. The statute sets forth specific guidance as to certain roles in the process, but for the most part, if we look at it broadly, it is a cooperative relationship to ensure that the statute is administered and the appropriate rules are in place to ensure safe patient access and a regulatory program that promotes business growth.
How do you plan to process requests for licenses?
We regulate many different industries, so we're very familiar with licensure processes, but the essence is there'll have to be an application with a fee paid. We will conduct thorough background investigations for the applicant, whether that's an entity or an individual, and the affiliated individuals for a business entity to ensure they meet the baseline criteria and statute.
We can't talk about this without talking about the potential revenues from this expanded industry. We've seen figures something in the neighborhood of $700 million. Where will that taxation happen?
The excise tax, which is the primary revenue generator, if you will, that I think that's being discussed here, is done at the provisioning center level. So they're required to collect that excise tax based on their gross receipts and remit that quarterly to the Department of Treasury.
All right. So that's at the dispensary level. Will they also have to pay like an annual licensing fee?
Yes, all the facilities will pay an application fee at the time of applying for licensure, and then there is also an annual regulatory assessment that is assessed on all the facilities except for the safety compliance facilities that's intended to finance the regulatory program and the costs, not only of LARA and the board, but also Attorney General and Treasury costs as well.
How will Lara interact with the state treasury in handling all of this, keeping accurate records of who has and hasn't paid their taxes? And I guess keeping in mind the backdrop that this is all still illegal in the eyes of the federal government, is it not?
That is correct. There hasn't been any change on the federal level. The tax collection piece going through the Department of Treasury, compliance will be necessary in order to maintain licensure with all provisions of the law, one of which is remitting that excise tax to the Department of Treasury. The act authorizes, or requires, I should say, a statewide monitoring system that we will be implementing. Licensees are required to adopt a third-party system that can transmit data to this statewide monitoring system that will track many aspects of the industry, one of which being sales. So there will be the ability to reconcile tax payments with the gross receipts and the sales of the provisioning centers.
So this is pretty much under the umbrella of what Lara does all the time anyway.
Correct. We view it as a regulatory program. I think the placement of the program makes sense because what our agency does at its core is licensure and regulation. So regardless of the industry at hand, there are certain facets of licensing and regulation that are common among all of these programs.
As we talk about the changes that are coming with the medical marijuana industry in Michigan, I guess we have to talk about the fact communities can opt out of this, can't they? So even if the state law sets all of this up, a city or township could pass an ordinance banning facilities in their area, even if they're already operating?
The municipalities do have control over participation in the facility program, if you will. Without opting in, the facilities won't be able to gain licensure. They can't operate in a municipality that hasn't adopted an authorizing ordinance.
What do you expect this new system to mean for existing caregivers?
Well, the existing caregiver model is still in existence and remains unchanged. So patients who either want to grow on their own or continue to utilize caregivers are free to continue to do so. I think it's possible that there'll be more of a transition to this new program, and the law specifically requires certain facilities to have on staff someone with at least 2 years of experience as a registered caregiver in Michigan. So they have that ability to transition to this new model, and I'm sure over time we'll see some of that start to transition.
Andrew Brisbois, director of the new Bureau of Medical Marijuana Regulation. It's an arm of the State Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs. Andrew, thank you so much for speaking with us. I know you've got a very, very busy few months ahead getting ready for all of this.
Certainly. We appreciate the time.
Congressman Dan Kildee's decision to not seek the Democratic nomination for governor has changed the playing field for existing and potential candidates, and that includes Dr. Abdul El-Sayed. He'd stepped down earlier this year as Detroit's public health director to run for governor, joining a Democratic field, including former State Senator Gretchen Whitmer. Dr. Abdul El-Sayed with me now. Welcome to Stateside.
Honored to be here, Cynthia.
So you became Detroit's public health director only in the fall of 2015. Why leave so soon to run for governor?
Look, I was rebuilding an agency that was shut down when my city was facing municipal bankruptcy. We were rebuilding it around the well-being of children, some of the most vulnerable kids in our state. And I was watching as the same system of emergency management was poisoning the same kinds of kids I was trying to protect in Flint, doing my work in Detroit. And that was a big wake-up call for me. When you look at the system of government as business that the current administration has really touted, you see that it's not just public health that gets cut when you cut corners trying to cut costs. It's also the fact that you look at our economy and it has not leaned forward. It's losing its young, bright talent every year. I graduated from the University of Michigan in 2007, and I'm calling my classmates, and they're not here. They've made investments in building that future in places like Chicago and places like LA and New York because they don't believe in the future of our economy. And it's not just the economy. It's not just public health. It's you look at our public schools. We spend less per pupil per year than any other regional state. And you can see the effects on our test scores. Over the past 8 years, our test scores have gone up by the lowest amount of all 50 states. And it's not just that. It's the fact that we're told that we can either have our economy or we can have our environment, but we can't have both. That's in contrast to what we're seeing happen in China, where there is a boom in investments in renewable energies that don't wed us to a system of climate change and to poisoning our natural resources and are creating huge amounts of jobs. We could have that right here in Michigan, where we have tremendous amounts of both engineering and manufacturing talent.
What was the process? Where did the seed get planted and grow to say, you know what? I'm going to run for governor. I've never held elected office, but I'm running for governor.
Well, we've been able to build the Detroit Health Department over the time that I was there from an institution of 5 city employees and 85 contractors that sat in the back of the building where you pay your parking tickets to being a 5-campus, 220-person institution. We multiplied the funding for public health 10 times. And that took being able to work with diverse kinds of actors, to be able to get down in the trenches, find shared interests, inspire people to believe in what we could do as an agency, and then get stuff done. We built programs to give kids access to glasses free of charge at school. We delivered over 1,000 pair of glasses in the first 4 months of the program. We stood up to some of the biggest corporate polluters. We were told that there's no way that you're going to get them to change their policies. We forced Marathon Petroleum to reduce their emissions of sulfur dioxide, investing $10 million of their own money to do it. When we heard about the Flint water crisis, we realized that given the state of Detroit public schools, it may be that kids were exposed to lead in their own schools, the place that where we systematically concentrate our most vulnerable people most of the day, most of the year. And so we had them tested in 6 months, 360 schools. That protocol that we put together in 3 weeks, that's now model practice nationwide. I know what I was able to do leading an institution to believe in what was possible if we were willing to roll up our sleeves and get the work done. That's what state government needs right now. We have state government leadership that right now thinks of government as business, thinks of things like Flint as a write-off, as a liability. Government is about delivering a set of services that create opportunity for people who fundamentally need it. It needs people who believe in what it can do, believe in the value of the people it serves. And I know from my experience at the health department that I've been able to do that. And so I watched as our state was failing fundamentally. I asked myself what my responsibility to the moment was. And I realized that in a state where we have the single biggest man-made public health disaster in recent memory, as a doctor, my skills are needed. In a state where our public education system is failing, my skills as an educator, a former professor, are needed. I realized in a state that's the least transparent, one of the least accountable in the entire country, that my skills as a public servant are needed. And in a state that's failed to create opportunities for millennials, my experience as a millennial is probably needed. And so I realized that there was an opportunity here to be able to serve. And, you know, I grew up believing that in this country, when you're called to service, you serve. And so I hope I'm able to do that for my state.
I'm speaking with Dr. Abdul El-Sayed, who is Democratic candidate for governor. Now, you're 32.
I am.
You are Muslim. So if you win, you would be the youngest U.S. governor since Bill Clinton was elected back as governor of Arkansas, and you would be America's first Muslim governor. So what do you say to voters who look at you and have misgivings about either your age or your religion, especially since we're a state that went for Donald Trump?
Yeah. So on the age point, we have to remember that our first governor was Stevens T. Mason. He was 25 years old.
The boy governor.
when he took our state from a territory into a state. And I think young people bring a sense of purpose, a sense of enthusiasm, a sense of building the future that we're going to have to live. I don't have kids yet, and I worry a lot about whether or not my kids are going to have the same things that I had as the child of immigrants to this country. And I don't have to look very far, except for my own cousins, to know exactly what it was that the state gave me, an economy that employed both of my parents, public education that allowed me to take advantage of some great opportunities that I got. I didn't go to private school until they paid me to do it in grad school. And, you know, a system where I could breathe clean air and drink clean water without having to fear. I worry about where that's going. And I know that I'm right now trying to fight for the kind of democracy that gave me the opportunities that I had that I hope my kids have too. And I think that comes with youth. And as for faith, you know, this is a country that was founded in an ideal that told us that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are created equal. Our First Amendment tells us that there shall be no religious test to citizenship and all that comes with citizenship. And I think right now, you know, as we've traveled this state, we've talked to people all over the state. You've been going all over. All over. 30 counties, nearly 50 cities, hundreds of rooms, thousands of voters.
Quite a listening tour.
It is. And what I've found as we've listened is that people are a lot less interested in how you pray than they are in what you pray for. I know that I pray for my family, my wife, Sarah, my parents, my state, and my country, like many people of faith or no faith at all pray for or hope for. And these are the kinds of things that I think unite us. And I know that as we have conversations about the challenges that our state faces, as we have conversations about the solutions to those challenges, I found that people are a lot more interested in what I have to say about that. Now, I'll tell you, I trained as a doctor. You know, and I had my fair share of patients while I was in training who didn't quite want to see a Muslim doctor. And I said, look, that's fine. I'm going to put my hands where you can see them. I'm going to sit in the corner and I'm going to ask you what's wrong. Just tell me about what's wrong and what hurts. And after about 30 minutes, they look at me and say, fine, you can put your hands down now. And I tell them, look, here's what I think we can do for you. In the case of one patient of mine at the VA, He waited after he had gotten discharged from the hospital. He waited around a couple hours until I was free. And he pulled me aside and said, listen, I'm really thankful that you took the time to listen. And you really, really cared about my care. And, you know, for that, I'm very thankful, especially given the way that I treated you. And what that taught me is that if you are willing to listen, if you are really about solving problems, then people don't really care what you look like or what your faith is. They care a lot more about what you want to do for them and their families. And I know that I come to this in the most honest way possible. I was never intending to run for office for exactly those reasons. But I realized that in a moment where our democracy is really suffering, where it seems like we're going back on our greatest ideals, ideals that have made us the greatest country in the world, that we have to come back to who we are as a society. And that's a group of people who've always been able to come together around challenges that we face them head on and solve them. And I hope that we can do that.
As you think about your campaign goals and policy initiatives, can you give us an idea of what you feel that your top priorities would be if you get elected?
Yeah, too many Michiganders right now feel locked out of our economy. It's an economy that's bent over backwards to accommodate large corporations that have largely either sent their jobs overseas or given their jobs to robots. And right now, there's a responsibility that we have to make sure that we're creating the means of an economy that allows everybody access and good jobs. So that is number one. We've got to think about what a 21st century economy looks like. That means quitting playing from a 20th century playbook, as the Snyder administration and too many administrations before him have done. Second, we have to fix public schools. It's not just in places like Detroit or Benton Harbor or Flint. It's all over the state. We have to reinvest in our public schools. We have to be thinking about what universal pre-K can look like to create fertile minds that can take advantage of school. We have to make sure that there are opportunities beyond college for 1 or 2 year training programs for folks who may not be able to go to college. And then number three, we have to fix both our infrastructure and our environment, and we can do both at the same time. I was in the UP and having conversations with folks about the fact that they pay 50% more in electricity costs up there than we pay down here in the Mitten. And that's largely because it's hard to truck petroleum. Well, we don't actually have to truck petroleum. You know, if you look at the Keweenaw Peninsula, a lot of studies are telling us that that would be the single best place that you could build wind farms. And that's where you have the crosswinds hitting each other to create the means of energy that's way cheaper to build opportunities for jobs and to free us of what has been right now a dependence on oil that leads to climate change and makes our kids sick. That is a big focus for us. And then finally, we have to make government more accountable. You know, you look at what happened in Flint, and it's clear that that leadership thought of Flint as just a write-off. Otherwise, they would have been in Flint. They would have been solving the problem. They would have been advocating far harder than they would have. That comes from a system of government right now that's just not accountable to people. It's overly gerrymandered, so not every election matters. It's not transparent because you can't really find out what's happening in the governor's office or with the legislature. And there's too much money in it. You know, a political action committee for a corporation can invest 4 times more per race in a state legislative race than it can in a federal legislative race. That's absurd. And I think Michigan's people know that. And so we have to fix those problems.
So how do you, as someone who's never held elected office, beat all of that, the system, going in, working with, you talk about the gerrymandered system, working with state legislators. How do you see yourself doing that?
Well, look, when I walked into the Detroit Health Department on my first day, I had a lot of the same questions. How are you going to work in what was at that point and continues to be one of the hardest bureaucracies in the country? How are you going to get stuff done? And the point that I made is, A, we're going to build a culture. It's going to be about accountability, transparency, and collaboration. We're going to be honest about delivering the wins to the people who created those wins in state government. And if things go wrong, I will step up and take responsibility because that's what a leader does. And then it's about finding opportunities to work with folks across the aisle. And that's not just the representatives and the senators. That's also the people who voted them in. Because at the end of the day, our Constitution tells us that all political power shall be vested in the people. And if it's vested in the people, then the responsibility is to have a conversation with the people about what is in their best interests, to listen, to learn, and to deliver. And insofar as we are working to deliver a set of legislation that is in the best interest of the people, we will have that conversation with the people and the representatives. And one of our big responsibilities is to make sure that every election matters. Now, I'm running as a Democrat, but the reality is that anytime an election goes uncontested, what we are doing is robbing the people of the opportunity to choose. And so there's a responsibility for the Democratic Party, I think, to build up its farm team, for us to address the fact that we have one of the most gerrymandered states in the entire country and make sure every election matters. And when it comes time to push legislation, then we're going to have conversations with people in districts all over the state, as we've already been doing, about what is in their best interest and making sure that they recognize that there is a choice. And if they don't like the choice that they have, they should definitely come out in the polls for the next 2 years because they can make a choice again.
Dr. Abdul Al-Sayed, Democratic candidate for governor. Thank you so much for being with us, Doctor.
Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.
And that's today's Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.